that. First of all, you had to know an operating system called Unix to use it. If you did, you could communicate with other hackers and researchers in a growing network of fairly serious institutions around the world. The ability to instantly send and receive electronic mail and batches of scientific data seemed pretty revolutionary at the time, but again, only for those who mastered the arcane dialect of Unix. But now, fire up any Mac or PC, launch your free Netscape or Explorer web browser program, and try to see what you cannot get through the internet. Even for a dummy like me, it's easy as click, click, click. It's easy, it's fun, it's amazing and all that, but something has been kind of bothering me about it. I mean, where did all these advertisements come from? The internet used to be a serious, if somewhat tedious, tool for research and collaboration. Then it morphed into the World Wide Web, and suddenly it looks more and more like television. And all this seems to have happened in about the past 5 years. What we're seeing is the rapid emergence of the mother of all electronic media, and even though it's a lot more interactive and useful than television, suddenly it's following the commercial media model, that is, paid for by advertising. And this has happened so fast that it seems relevant to ask, how did it happen, and what does it mean? What are the implications of this? During this hour, Focus 580, our guest is Dan Schiller, professor of communication at the University of California at San Diego and author of the book Digital Capitalism, Networking the Global Market System, just published by the MIT Press. In the book, Professor Schiller details the evolution of the Internet from its nonprofit, governmental, and scientific beginnings to its for-profit commercial present. He also examines the growing role of large media corporations in shaping this evolution, and he documents the elimination of national barriers to telecommunications following the end of the Cold War, which coincided with the emergence of internet technology, enabling the consumer-driven model of the web to take on international dimensions. As we talk with Dan Schiller, you are invited into the conversation. You can join us around Champaign-Urbana, that is within the 217 area code, at 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Anytime during our conversation, if you're calling within the 217 area code, dial 333-WILL. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. Dan Schiller, good morning.
Good morning, Jack.
Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
A very interesting book.
Well, you've described it so well, I don't know if I have anything to say to your listeners, but let's see.
Well, that was a nutshell, so let's go into some details. And maybe to start with, let me ask you to describe in more detail the origins of the Internet as a project of the Defense Department and a few scientific researchers.
Yes, well, the Internet's origins, as is broadly known, lie in an earlier and much more limited system called the ARPANET, which was funded by a DOD agency, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, beginning in 1969, and contracting out to a few preferred military suppliers. The paradox of this, and the thing that I kind of find fascinating, is that the ARPANET, the origin of the Internet technology, and all of the subsequent developments around the Internet that followed are aimed at information sharing across islands, you might say, of computer power, at linking together otherwise unlinked islands of computer intelligence or processing power. And yet this motivation for information sharing, which sounds so attractive and which in many ways is attractive, originates at the heart of the garrison state, inside the very, very depths of the military-industrial complex, with, you know, every kind of guard and active way of keeping the general public from making use of the capability. This is the early history of this fantastically effective means for information sharing today, and that's a very paradoxical thing.
Yeah, so unless you were involved in those projects, you really wouldn't have even known about it.
No way, yeah. You wouldn't have heard about it at all. It was completely something that was within the larger project of building up systems, in this case computer network systems, that were ostensibly, and I say ostensibly because I simply don't find it a credible idea, nuke-proof, that if there was to be a nuclear exchange, as it's so euphemistically put in the lingo going back to the early 1970s and earlier, that we would have a system that the Russians couldn't shatter, that our computer science, our defense community would be able to continue functioning within the post-apocalyptic scenarios that the planners were creating.
Does this account for the origins of the design of the information transfer known as packets? This is, it seems like an arcane little term here, but it's pretty important to the way the Internet functions.
Yes. Well, yes, packet switching originates with the ARPANET and with some allied projects that were going on around it. And the key point is that in the initial development of this system, what was being linked was individual mainframe computers. This is the classic period of so-called big iron, where in order to go to, in order to get access to computer functionality, to computer processing power, you had to actually physically get to the computer, and it would be this giant machine huddled in some basement somewhere. I recall there being such machines actually on the campus of the University of Illinois,
right,
where not far from where I grew up. And you had to go to the machine. Well, the origins of the Internet lie in this ARPANET system, which made it possible for the machines, these individual islands of computer processing power, to be interconnected through a system known as packet switching, in which basically, rather than keeping a single circuit open, as we are at the moment on this telephone call, for the duration of our exchange, the computer data is sent out serially in a whole set of little packets that contain an address, each of them, and are sent out over multiple paths across a network and reassembled at the destination in the proper order.
So this is both more efficient and more robust?
Absolutely. It is demonstrably more efficient in the sense that today, after a long period in which the major telecommunications operators poo-pooed the efficiency of packet switching, they're all investing billions of dollars in it as the necessary infrastructure for an Internet-based or a proto-Internet-based extension of the general telecommunications system. There are other features that are also attractive, but the efficiency, meaning you can cram more data, you can cram more information down that network for the same amount of money or for less money than you can using the earlier technology of telecommunications, which is known as circuit switching.
Right. And plus, you can lose some of the data, actually, and some of it still be useful.
Yes. There are error-correcting features in a packet switch network so that if a single packet doesn't arrive, the system automatically says to the initiator, please send out the message again so we can try over, and this is an attractive option.
And it might take a few seconds, but it'll actually correct itself.
Yes. I mean, this is pretty evident in routine use of the Internet today.
Exactly.
You know, there's a lot of individual problems. There are even some general outages from time to time if a bank of modems goes down, as AOL had happened a couple of years ago. But the system as a whole works pretty well.
Okay. Well, I wanted to set that up because it seems pretty important for the way, as you mentioned, the way the Internet is used these days. In this scenario, you had these big iron computers and a few researchers using them in the Defense Department, sort of setting up as a very robust system in case of, whatever eventuality, nuclear attack, I suppose, being the worst. But then more and more people, more and more scientists were using this, and then along came personal computers.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to change just about everything.
Well, yes and no. I mean, there were a whole variety of initiatives here bundled together in what you're saying. In
okay.
the early 80s, the National Science Foundation, which is another U.S. Agency, gets into the act
yes.
and starts to develop a civilian version, if you will, of the by then Internet technology, and it's in the early mid-80s that people begin to speak of an Internet, a network of networks, because what's new here is that we're not just linking individual computers, as I said before was characteristic of the ARPANET, but actually linking individual networks into a network of networks. this is, to be sure, massively expedited by the growth of PC-based systems in offices across corporate America, across governments, across universities, government agencies across universities as well. And so, yes, the PC is responsible, but I would rather give it an organizational accent than a technological accent, in the sense that it is the massive and completely uncontained need by corporate America in particular for a series of cascading information-sharing functions that accounts for the rise of networking in any mode and eventually converging around this Internet technology.
Are we talking about the rapid growth of corporate local area networks?
Yes, that's, of course, a very major part of it. You've got corporate local area networks. They're not just limited to corporations, but corporations account for the lion's share of demand for these systems. And what they do is very prosaic in many cases, simply allowing a particular department or office to share computer files or to have joint access to certain kinds of instrumentation, printers, and the like. But as a result of putting in such networks, at first on a very modest scale within a particular office or within a particular department, it's very rapidly apparent to information system managers that why should we be content with the limits that are there on the system? Why shouldn't we continue to try to expand them and expand the domain and the range of information sharing potential? And it's the Internet's spectacular ability to accommodate this objective, to contribute to massively extended information sharing potential, that is specifically emblematized around email, but which has a broader significance that accounts for its wildfire success.
Sure. Now, I seem to recall in the early days of some of the local area networks, or LANs as we called them, there were wide area networks. There are different scales of these networks that were sort of, you know, in-house or, you know, within one corporation, maybe using some of the telephone system's backbone of, you know, lines crossing the country or the world. A lot of the systems were sort of proprietary, didn't use the same software, and wouldn't necessarily be able to communicate with other similar networks in other circumstances.
You've raised an important point here, Jack, because, in fact, the rights to Internet technology, in particular to the software protocols that create or establish cyberspace as a domain, these rights, and I'm speaking here of intellectual property rights, lie in the public domain. Because of the fact that the technology was funded by government, the rights to the Internet as a technical matter are not proprietary. And there is no way that the system could have taken on the significance and the rapidity and accelerating rapidity of growth that it has absent this publicly shared access to the underlying technology. This is important because the Internet's development had nothing to do with the free market, despite the relentless refrain that that's what it's all about, keep the government out of the business, so on and so forth. That's now, when we're in the process of full-scale commercialization. At the moments, and it was an extended moment, the decades, one might say, when the system was taking shape, it was a very different tune altogether. The tune that was being sung was, let's have special perquisites, let's make special rules, let's try to set this thing up at the government trough.
So the actual software, or the design of the software that makes the Internet possible, was developed and put into the public domain by the government, essentially.
Well, it was developed by government contractors, and there were some squabbles between some of these contractors who did want to take proprietary control over the Internet technology that they had contracted to create, but the government didn't let them. And so the system remained in the public domain, and this accounts for the ease of access to it that others have enjoyed.
Okay. What about the actual pipeline, or the system itself, the wires and cables that connect? NSF funded a number of supercomputer centers, such as the NCSA here in Champaign-Urbana, one at Stanford, several other places around the country. who constructed those? What did the actual physical structure of the Internet consist of, and who owned it?
Well, in the first instance, this system was, again, a not-for-profit system. And the bulk of the specialized instrumentation that was established to set up Internet functionality, if you will, was in public institutions, by and large. NSF contracting universities supplied the basis of it. It is only in the 1990s, in the middle of the 1990s, that the NSF, in its wisdom, spun off this system, as they say, and privatized it to allow the Internet system as a whole, and I'll return to some of the other elements in it in a minute, to become a corporate fiefdom in which major telecommunications vendors and a small group of other companies obtained a priority in controlling the infrastructure. Now, to return to the point before, the tangle of wires and circuits that the Internet has always built on have, in fact, always been part of the established telecommunications infrastructure that in the United States, at least, has been run by private companies. But it is the special software and other instrumentation that is applied to these circuits that sets up cyberspace as a special domain, as an electronic space. And this material, this software, this hardware, as I said, in the early years, lay significantly within the public domain. That is no longer the case.
Let me just take a moment to reintroduce our guest this morning. We're talking with Dan Schiller. He's a professor of communications at the University of California, San Diego, and we're talking about his book just published entitled Digital Capitalism, Networking the Global Market System, published by the MIT Press. We do have one caller waiting to talk, and we'll welcome others if you'd like to join the conversation. Within the 217 area code, you can call us at 333-WILL. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with the first caller here. This is a listener in Champaign County on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. I wanted to applaud you for carrying on your father's legacy. I was saying to myself, this is informant content, very much like Herb Schiller, and I was wondering if indeed that was the case. I think you can confirm that quickly. And vocal mannerisms are very reminiscent. So,
who do I have the pleasure of speaking with?
Well, I only know him from his audio broadcasts and his. I met him at one conference, so he wouldn't remember me, and I'd rather be anonymous, actually.
I see.
He'll come out here.
I shouldn't also, but just in the interest of some sort of public dialogue, yes, there's a Schiller legacy here. And
a lot of it published by U of I Press. One could do worse than mass communication in the American Empire.
Well, I'll pass along the compliment, and that's very nice of you to remember.
Uh-huh. Well, it's very pertinent stuff. So I didn't want to carry too far into this little side story about who is registering the domain names if they haven't changed it yet, but because it would probably lend too much of a conspiratorial tone to it. But the fact that this company out in Herndon, Virginia, near Foggy Bottom, is the one that's printing money by having the right to register domain names if it hasn't been altered yet is full of all sorts of spooks types. It seems like there's the legacy of the national security state followed the Internet along in a large extent. I'm sure, you know, you can look at just the mechanisms of concentration of economic power and see that this is the way the course of so-called privatization, the socialization of the costs and the privatization of the profits kind of thing that's so characteristic of America's military Keynesianism overall,
yes,
is right there, palpably. But there's also this side story that I don't know how much time you investigated it of this rather spooky group that had this money making.
The subsidiary to do the domain names.
Right.
Yeah, well, no, there's no question that there continues to be a very, very tight interlock between the military and the industrial apex of the U.S. system. There's no question that this is so, and it's abundantly confirmed in a whole variety of ways in a recurrent pattern. But the key point, I think, needs to be made that whereas in the early years of the ARPANET and then the Internet technology, the military interest was uppermost and definitive in insulating the system from every kind of public process or control, that being a quote from one of the policy framers for Internet policy, a man named Anthony Rutkowski. That is not as much the case today because the dominant role today, the lead role, is taken by what's called the private sector, which, as you suggest, is still very much interlocked with military and intelligence concerns, but which has still its own objectives and its own needs. And so in a, you know, in some context, for example, in the context of debate over whether encryption technologies ought to be allowed to be exported, you see the actual conflict between these two members of the American decision-making complex in which the military and the enforcement agencies are intent on preventing exports of this sensitive encryption technology, whereas the commercial companies that are increasingly calling the shots say, no, we've got to be allowed to.
Yeah, well, it is also not a surprise that this is the way it would go, since we have GE, which is owning NBC, is also, I think, at least number in the top five military contractors. So, plus ça change in some ways. Thanks a lot, and I'll listen and let someone else call in, too.
Thanks. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks for the call. I wanted to get your answer to a series of questions that relate to the privatization of the Internet. You know, we sort of talked about the origins and talked a little bit about the fact that it has changed in character radically toward the commercial sort of free enterprise sector. How and when was the Internet privatized? To what extent is the government still involved? And was there any discussion of how this would happen and, you know, some of the public interest issues that are involved in this change?
You know, it's interesting. There is discussion, and nominally you can be a part of such discussions, but as has been true in a series of contexts pertaining to telecommunications policy in the United States for many, many decades, the work that you have to do to become an effective participant in the discussion and the expense, really, of becoming an effective party to such discussions effectively forestalls anything approaching truly democratic participation because, for example, just to take one example, the kinds of news sources that you need to be able to pay attention to and to ingest and to use as the basis of policy response, depending on whatever end of the system you're trying to work in. These news sources, and I'm speaking here of specialized newsletters and, in fact, of Internet-based news sources that are created by on subscription basis, they can cost upwards of $1,000, $2,000 a year. Well, any kind of public system, any kind of public interest group that wants to play a role in an effective way has to be cued into this news on a breaking news basis every day, and it costs too much money for many of them to have that kind of access, particularly if they're located outside the Beltway, which many of them, of course, are and should be. So that's one factor that prevents the kind of democratic participation that one would like to see about such critical decisions as building out the Internet or privatizing the Internet. The government, of course, as we've just said, does remain vitally involved as a matter of national policy, but perhaps the overarching and, again, paradoxical feature of the government's role is to insist time and time and time again against all comers that the Internet must, as a matter of principle, remain free of the regulations that they argue have scarred and in other ways punished the prevailing telecommunications system outside the Internet. In other words, the Internet must be free of regulation, it must be free of any kind of government intrusion. All that that will do is to create punishing and disturbing and debilitating and disfiguring features that will will take away from the ultimate goal, the ultimate goal never being mentioned other than the extension of market relationships.
Right.
So this is another paradox around the Internet. The government is the most forceful advocate, almost besides the business sector itself, of keeping the government itself out of Internet regulation.
Uh-huh. So what, in fact, was spun off from government control at, you know, during the transition in the past few years?
Well, the National Science Foundation had, as you said, Jack, you know, contracted out the creation of certain key points for the interchange of data across the growing Internet system. And these network access points were just a few in number and located at supercomputer facilities and a couple of them in Washington and more sensitive sorts of areas, you might say. The government contracts had built those and had helped to underwrite the specialized circuits, the telecommunication circuits that link them across the country and even more broadly, more generally across the world in a budding way. In the mid-90s, the National Science Foundation privatized this system, turning the network access points over to the leading telecommunications contractors. MCI was one, and I think IBM. And opened the way for private providers of Internet backbone services, it's called, the aggregators, the big telecom companies that work to distribute aggregated traffic from point to point across the system, and that the local or retail Internet service providers hook up to in order to exchange their traffic. These network access providers were free now to build their own network access points as a private matter. And so the Internet shifted through this process at its wholesale level, you might say, into corporate hands.
At the same time, there was a very rapid expansion of demand for Internet services and the networks that make it possible, the backbone, as you put it. And in fact, there was a very rapid global expansion of these networks. As I sort of hinted at in the introduction of the program, this coincided with, you know, the post-Cold War decade. And really, you detail that this had a very powerful driving effect on U.S. economic policy vis-a-vis developing countries around the world, sort of driving the wholesale elimination of national barriers in favor of private development and enabling these large, becoming very large transnational corporations who have the technology and the capital to take control of the former nationalized systems and really make a global infrastructure.
Yeah, you're pointing to another absolutely critical change that's occurring in the present, even as we speak. It used to be that national telecommunications systems, including the U.S. national system to an extent, were framed by truly domestic networks that were built up as a matter of national development, either by public actors, government actors, as occurred through most of the world, or by publicly regulated private companies, as occurred exceptionally in the United States, companies like AT&T preeminently, and that these national networks would effectively hand off signals from one to another as was called for when signals were sent, telephone calls or increasingly data across national borders. Today, and for the last really a couple of decades, the thrust has been in a very different direction towards the creation of supranational, that is, transnational telecommunications networks that do not hand off between national entities, but which increasingly work to distribute signals within an entirely proprietary system that spans political borders. So a company like MCI WorldCom, for example, is building out a network throughout capital cities of Europe into Asia, and of course building on its established very extensive U.S. network so as to provide for a very elite group of clients specialized services that allow linkages that are more efficient and more effective from the point of view of transnational corporate users of telecommunications directly between head office, say, and factory floor, head office, say, in Stuttgart and factory floor in Detroit, if we were using the example of Daimler Chrysler, for example. Mm-hmm.
At this, as this process progressed and the desire to connect and interconnect and as you say, establish supranational networks progressed, there were international negotiations which essentially broke down a lot of the national barriers. And the U.S. government was at the forefront of pushing for a liberalizing of telecommunications policy around the world. How did that all unfold?
Well, this is a very complicated story, and it's an extremely important story. Let me stress, as a preface to my comment on this, that the part of the story that has to do with internet negotiations specifically remains largely untold, and I hope that some historian of the internet as an international system, or I should say a transnational system, will soon take on the challenge of trying to document and analyze the specific features of internet-related negotiations that account for the spread of the internet across national borders like wildfire in the last 5 to 10 years. Having made that point, yes, the U.S. government was the preeminent actor in the liberalization of global telecommunications systems. Liberalization sounds like a nice word, liberal, I suppose, unless you're focused on a more conservative self-identity. It sounds like a good word, but liberalization basically means making room for a corporate takeover, and in this case, preeminently a transnational corporate takeover of what had been more often a welfarist kind of function, a public service, which, to be sure, did not always perform anywhere nearly as adequately as the U.S. telecommunications system performed, but nevertheless made room for, in a limited way, certain public service features, not least in the employment features of telecommunications. Telecommunications has historically been one of the most heavily unionized industries around the world, and the international union body that exists continues to have, I think, something like 4 or 5 million members around the world from unionized telecommunications systems. But the point is that with liberalization, there is a frontal attack on these public service features, on the public accountability features. And it's a very, again, paradoxical situation. There is no question but that the current build-out of telecommunications systems, and I'm not speaking here just of internet systems, but of telecommunications more broadly, cellular-based systems, land-based systems, satellite systems, submarine cables, the current build-out of telecommunications systems around the world is absolutely unprecedented. There are 50 million new land lines coming in a year around the world, and there are now something like 800 million land telephone lines in the world, which is up eightfold since 1960. It's an unprecedented build-out. The key point is it is a build-out that, despite making more room for more users, more household users, is in the hands of transnational corporations, not evincing any particular public accountability or responsibility, and in particular, not giving any sense or any promise of addressing what, to my eyes, is the defining feature of the emerging era, which is a what might be called a digital divide, as the Consumer Federation of America has labeled it. But it's not just a domestic digital divide, it's a transnational digital divide.
They want to go where the market is profitable, and
absolutely,
if markets are not profitable, then they're not interested in providing service.
And you can't blame them.
Right.
This is ordinary business practice, right. You see. I mean, let's take a domestic example so I can make the point plain here, because it's a mistake to think that it exists only in, Latin America or Africa or South Asia. It's also, although be it in a better register, the same tendency toward a digital divide is evident in the United States. In a recent study, almost half of American households can be called modest users of telecommunications services. And they have, say, only one phone line, no cell phone. Possibly they have internet access. and at most one of what's called a vertical service, like call waiting or caller ID. The average monthly bill for all of the telecommunications and TV services of these modest users, so in other words, it includes cable TV, is about $60. And this study, by the way, is a Consumer Federation of America survey. On the other side are what they call premier households, which account for about a quarter of the total in the United States. Of these, 70% have a second line, 87% have internet access, 91% have a cell phone, half own a fax machine, and 70% by at least three vertical services. Their average monthly bill for all telecommunications and TV services is about $200. Mm-hmm. So the differential is between $60 and $200. It's a $140 differential. If you were a diversified telephone or telecommunications carrier, who would you cater to? Mm-hmm. You'd have to cater to the $200 family. And in fact, what we find scattered through the business reporting that dominates coverage of these issues is just this. It is said in the Wall Street Journal not too long ago that about 20% of AT&T's customers account for about 80% of AT&T's profits. That's why AT&T, like the other major carriers, is doing what it can to discourage people who do not make a lot of long-distance calls, who do not have, cell phones, who are not interested in vertical services. AT&T is doing what it can to discourage such people from staying on its network by imposing minimum fees and so forth. Well, the supreme historical achievement of American telecommunications, and make no mistake about it, it is an achievement, has been the thing called universal service, which means something like 95% of American households, and there are unevennesses, and the term universal is really not still quite adequate, but it's closer in the United States to the universal service ideal than anywhere else, at least historically, and the United States realized this ideal earlier than any other part of the world. The supreme historical achievement of universal service is in danger of becoming irrelevant. I think that is a very, very significant and alarming trend, and one that requires exactly the sort of massive public debate and discussion that you were hinting at earlier might well be needed.
We have just about 12 minutes left in this hour. I want to mention our guest again, Dan Schiller, professor of communications at the University of California at San Diego, and his book we're discussing, Digital Capitalism, Networking the Global Market System, recently published by the MIT Press. And as I say, we have just about 10 or 12 minutes left. If you'd like to join our conversation, please do so before we run out of time. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. I want to make sure we talk a bit more about the commercialization of the web and the sort of grab for dominance on the part of advertising media. I mean, advertising, looking at the web as an advertising medium, yeah. which it never was intended to be, but, suddenly it clearly is. And there's a point in the book you mentioned, a 1994 speech by the CEO of Procter & Gamble, sort of a call to arms, declaring that advertisers and corporate marketers must make the new media dependent on commercial sponsorship. This is a major change in the nature of the web.
Yes, it's a great speech, by Edwin Arzt, that was the then CEO of Procter & Gamble. It's what made it important was that Procter & Gamble is one of the two largest commercial advertisers in the United States and indeed in the world. And so when the CEO of the largest advertiser in the world says, we've got to turn the web into a commercial medium, the advertising community, as it's called, stands up and listens. And so there was a variety of organizational initiatives that followed quickly in the wake of that speech. I'd like to insert one other point, which is that the speech was written by Robert Herbold. Robert Herbold went on from a very top position in marketing at Procter & Gamble to become one of the inner suite of advisors and executives he is in one of the top executives at the Microsoft Corporation. Mm-hmm. So there's, in the career of this one individual, a kind of emblem of the shift towards commercialization that that we're talking about of the web. Yes, the there were a whole variety of features about the web that made it attractive to advertisers, although they've had some skepticism as well. You know, putting their toe in the water and checking it out and then saying, well, let's wait till it gets a little warmer, then we'll really dive in. But there's no question now that the web has become a very, very pervasively saturated commercial medium, and there is no way that that's going to be relinquished. The web will remain a commercial medium, and indeed I would venture to say that unless there's a fundamental restructuring effort requiring government intervention, there will be an intensification of the kinds of commercial services that piggyback on the web and that connect the web to, in particular, the television system.
You go on to quote the head of Procter & Gamble Advertising in 1998, stating, quote, "We have a vested interest in making the web the most effective marketing medium in history."
Well, you know, that's quite a challenge to make the web a more effective marketing medium than television. And there's still skepticism that that it will replace television, and I think that in a limited way, that is well-founded skepticism. I say a limited way because it's not an either-or proposition. The fact is that advertising and sponsorship and commercial control over media in the United States are growing more and more powerful rather than less across the entire front of media activity, including now, of course, the web. And so the challenge of making the web more significant than television is in a way a misnomer. The point that's really significant is that all of the media are being increasingly commercialized, if that's possible, in the case of television in particular. And one of the entry points for this discussion is the web's interactive features. There is a whole host of experimentation going on to try to mold the interactive nature of the web and the beautiful qualities for communication and the potential for exchange that that interactivity makes possible, that it underwrites, to mold that to the sales apparatus's needs. And that is, I would say, the primary task at hand. It's still a very open question which commercial media will predominate, which will be most successful in spearheading what is still a very unstable and unfixed medium and turning it into a stable feature of the mediascape, whether it's going to be the established television networks, the conglomerates that own most of the television networks, or interlopers like Yahoo or America Online, remains an open question. There is a tremendous industrial conflict and a great fluidity as a result over which specific industry members and indeed industry sectors are going to succeed in, you might say, preempting the web's functionality. But that it will be preempted for and on behalf of major consumer product advertisers is at this point, I think, a settled question.
We have a call to talk with. I want to include them before we run out of time. We have about 5 minutes left, so let's do that. This is a listener in Salem on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. If I may just mention a few areas, and then I'll hang up and like to hear your response. It does seem like a kind of uncontrolled evolution has occurred, you know, the way, but yet now it's going to come back and be limited to just some being in control and having access, which is why I believe we need the role of government, you know, in regulating, legislating, enforcing, and deciding what's best for all the people of our country. And then, as I don't understand too much the mechanical aspects, but I remember in the 70s where they had the computers in a big room to keep them cool. And I just wondered, the more you bind energy, does that create more heat? You know, and I know they give off radiation. So should we be concerned if they are contributing to global warming, the computers?
I'm not knowledgeable about the second question that you ask about global warming. I'm certainly in a shared position with you that it's a problem. Anything that might be a factor there contributing to it should be looked at, but I'm not aware that computers are a major feature in that process.
We'll save that for another day.
Yeah. The role of government in legislating and regulating that you started off with, I think, is absolutely critical. We've come to the point in the United States where there's a widespread and largely almost created sense that government is an evil no matter what. It's not any longer, as it was for the framers, a necessary evil, and I'm emphasizing necessary. It's just an evil. And this is an untenable position. It is an untenable position for anything that approximates democracy, and regardless of where you put the balance of the accent, that the framers believed it was a necessary evil has got to be emphasized, and here is a prime occasion for emphasizing it. You're absolutely right. The government and we behind it have got to find ways of turning this supremely capacious and prospectively vitalizing medium of the Internet back to the citizenry of this country.
There's so much more to talk about, and we're going to run out of time in about 3 minutes. We're not going to get to a lot of things, but there is, you know, as you suggest, the web has a tremendous potential to be useful for a lot of things, and I use it every day for research, and it is very useful, despite whatever qualms or concerns we have about the way it's evolving. But there is one issue that I think, you know, bears a little bit of emphasis, and I'd like to ask about, you know, to what extent is editorial content on the web, which we count on, influenced by this increasing advertising support? Is this any different than, say, television, magazines, etc.?
Well, if anything, as many commentators have noted, the web is showing a willingness, that is to say, the institutions that are active in providing news on the web are showing a willingness to bend editorial categories to make possible incursions by the commercial side, the advertising side, on editorial matter that would, up to this point, have been unthinkable in non-internet media. And the result has been, and the key feature has been, a more general tendency within the media system to give greater power to sponsors in defining editorial matter and shaping it in conforming it to the needs of finding most needed audiences, as advertisers put it, and excluding others. So that there's no doubt that the last of the paradoxes I'll mention, that the web remains an incredibly useful tool for finding information, but it is already the case that a few hundred sites gather in the by far the largest share of total internet traffic, and a few hundred sites is not so far from John Malone's old idea of a 500 channel television system, and the conglomerates that run television have shown themselves perfectly able to deal with 500 channels, and that means a growing concentration of power over editorial matters by a very few number of entities. I'm worried about that, and I think people should be.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, and with the proviso that there is much in the book we've been discussing that we didn't get to, as per usual. There's a whole chapter on the impact of the Internet on the higher learning industry, and I think that might bear a conversation in itself, but we'll have to save that for another day. And I would just tell folks, if you'd like to read more on the subject, you could certainly look for the book Digital Capitalism, the subtitle Networking the Global Market System, and the author has been our guest, Dan Schiller, S-C-H-I-L-L-E-R, and it's published by MIT Press. And to you, Dan Schiller, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jack. I've enjoyed it very much.